Hello, and welcome to the second Vic Park audio walk. You've downloaded the walk that follows the path from the Vlaming statue to Chevron Park and back. Right now, you should be standing by the statue. This walk is about 2 kilometres and will take you around 45 minutes to an hour. There are plenty of benches along the way if you want a rest. In fact, I'd encourage you to take your time and look around while you listen to the history and imagine the people and places described for you. As you walk, you'll be directed to a landmark where you can listen to the next story. After that story, you'll receive directions to the next landmark. When the directions are finished, you'll be asked to press pause and move to the next landmark. Just to make things easier, when each story has finished, you'll hear a bell. That's the signal that you're about to hear directions to the next landmark. Some are quite close to each other and the directions are simple, but others will need a turn on the footpath. Please make sure you have plenty of water and wear sunscreen and a hat, especially in the summer. Europeans began settling in this area in 1829. But the Whadjuk Noongar people have inhabited the southwest for more than 50,000 years. As you take the walk, remember that you're on Aboriginal land, and please show respect. And thank you to the town of Vic Park for providing funding for this and the follow-on walk, and thank you to Vic Park Rotary, who generously auspiced the project. Today, this landscape is sculptured and developed into prime riverfront frontage. That was always a vision. In 1893, the West Australian remarked, "Ultimately, the reclamation of the riverside flats should extend to the causeway. The walker or the equestrian would then be enabled to reach the coming artificial attractions of the Association Cricket Ground or the natural beauties of Victoria Park without discomfort. Such a walk or drive along the banks of a broad and beautiful river lined with trees and covered with turf would be a delight to both visitors and residents alike." But only 3 years earlier, the Western Mail had a different idea. "Victoria Park, or a large slice of it, will shortly be converted into what is really a dung heap." Rubbish and sewerage play their part in the local history, but on this walk you'll also hear some strange stories from this part of the world, the history of Burswood Island, an early aeronaut, some undeserving criminals, and many others. Press pause and walk along the path to the intersection with the feeder road leading to Burswood on Swan, and I'll tell you the story of Burswood's lost canal. I mentioned Henry Camfield in the first walk, but if you haven't taken that yet, just to recap. He came out here in 1829, one of the first colonists, but too late for the very best land. He named his grant here Burswood, with a double R, after the family estate near Tunbridge Wells in southern England. A grand old Georgian hall set amongst woodland, with stables, a gamekeeper, and no doubt the occasional poacher. That house and its grounds could have been the ideal location for Bridgerton or any adaptation of a Jane Austen novel, but try to visualise it here in swampland. Hard, isn't it? I suppose Camfield wanted something to remind him of home, but if he thought he could reinvent the family property here by the Swan, he got a brutal wake-up call when he realised the expense involved in transforming West Australian marshland into something like a country house in Kent. Camfield's time in the Swan River colony was short-lived. He was in Albany within a couple of years, but the name Burswood survives. So, incidentally, does Camfield. You're walking parallel to Camfield Drive, and up ahead you'll pass the Camfield Restaurant. Have a look at a map of Perth, and you'll see the Swan River snaking down from Herne Hill to the section we call Perth Water, just the other side of Harrison Island. Though it was formed in the Cretaceous era, about 60 million years ago, that's young for a river. You can also see at once why early colonists wanted a canal to cut through Burswood. The river journey between Fremantle and Guildford was arduous. It could take all day to get from one to the other. And it involved dragging barges over sandbars at Harrison Island. Cutting a canal through the peninsula to circumvent the peninsula could save an hour or more in travel time. In 1831, the task of redesigning and overseeing construction of the canal fell to Henry Reveley. You might have met him already on the Fremantle and Coogee walks. He was the architect of the Fremantle Roundhouse, friend of Percy Bysshe Shelley, and accidental resident of the Swan River Colony. To say that no better man for the job could be found at the colony isn't saying much, since almost no one else had real engineering expertise. But the story of the canal is a useful analogy to the history of the colony. What looked on paper to be both necessary and achievable literally became bogged down in disputes over money, logistics, and, well, bog. In the 1830s, still the golden years of the Industrial Revolution in Britain, canals were being built across the industrial north. So to deal with the problem of slow and arduous transport, a canal was the first solution. Not necessarily the best. In March 1831, John Crane won the tender to construct the canal, 275 yards long, to a maximum depth of 8 feet. 2 months later, he was threatening to strike. The entire project was estimated to involve 3,000 cubic yards of cutting, but by June, that had already blown out to well over 4,000 cubic yards. But that wasn't the worst of Reveley's problems. The canal was silting up, so Reveley's solution was to build two dikes, one either side. That might have solved the drainage issue, but the government didn't have the funds. At this point, all the stakeholders could have reached a compromise involving, of course, the division of fast-disappearing money, but time had dragged on, and just to make matters worse, Captain James Stirling returned to Britain to raise more funds for the whole colony, taking with him all the paperwork to do with the canal's construction and the budget. Years later, in a paper delivered to the Institute of Engineers, James Thompson would tell his audience that Reveley was an architect, not an engineer, and the project should never have been given to him. Perhaps not. But who else was remotely qualified? Stirling, John Septimus Roe, and the first colonists had sailed out to found a colony on the Swan River without an architect or engineer, and it was pure luck they met Reveley in South Africa on their voyage out. Besides, it was Stirling, not Reveley, who took all the plans and the budget with him. The canal was built, but its most effective job was to make Burswood Island, as the peninsula was called, into an actual island. By the time it was finished, roads had been built and they were much more efficient. The canal was filled in around the 1940s and would have vanished altogether, but in landscaping the grounds surrounding the new casino in the 1980s, fragments were found and refilled with water. If you walk around the casino, you'll come up to two narrow ponds abutting the apartment blocks, all that remains of the Burswood Canal. Now, follow the path around Burswood on Swan till you come to an artificial lake, and I'll tell you about Vic Park's endless war against a feared enemy. If you're old enough to remember this part of Perth before the casino was built, you'll remember the grey, brutalist Swan Portland cement factory looming over Vic Park as you drove up Great Eastern Highway towards the airport. It was built in 1919 and closed in 1997. Until the casino was built in the mid-1980s, the peninsula was an industrial wasteland with the cement works, a rubbish tip and sewerage treatment tanks. Look at early charts and you'll understand at once why Burswood was an obvious site for waste treatment. It was close to the city and other forms of use for the land hadn't been a success so far. This area's reputation was so bad, the name of the local train station was once changed from Burswood to Rivervale. Now, you may have heard of the Emu Wars, the Dingo Wars, or other wars we've conducted against nature. In the 1930s, Vic Park had the Cockroach Wars. In the beginning, the cockroaches were winning. There was a plague of them across Vic Park. Town Councillor Ma described houses where it was impossible to walk in the backyard without treading on them. The problem was discussed in Parliament, where words like plague and pestilence were liberally used. If wars are meant to be won or lost, this was one we lost, convincingly. Anybody looking at a map of Burswood probably thought they could see the problem at once. If the local rubbish tips looked like an obvious suspect, people were avoiding the real culprit. Like rats, cockroaches are opportunistic. If there is a food source and other environmental factors are suitable, they'll move in. In the 1930s, we were providing ideal ecosystems for cockroaches, not in our rubbish dumps, but in our homes. Most houses built in Vic Park were weatherboard, with steep pitched roofs and stumping to raise the floor level above the ground. The local councils might as well have been advertising free 5-star hotel accommodation to cockroaches, and this was true not just for Vic Park but for all of Perth. Weatherboard houses, sink wells, and steep pitched roofs are paradise for our pests. The 1930s saw one of the great suburban boom periods in Perth, especially in this section south of the river. And as we built, others moved in. So while it was easy to point to Vic Park's waste management as the guilty party, the real problem was closer to home, you might say. Cockroaches can be problematic for people with asthma or dust allergies. And no one likes coming out in the middle of the night to see one crawling across the fruit bowl. But here's something to respect about them. They really are generous, sociable, and warm-hearted. When they discover a good environment, an old house with lots of nooks and crannies and a water supply, oh, and flat beer, which they love, they send out messages inviting other roaches far and wide, and before long, others turn up in their hundreds to move in. This is an insect that can live for a month without its head. And we've got something very wrong about them that we're only just beginning to correct. There's been an argument around for a long time that cockroaches quickly develop resistance to pesticides. So spray with Mortine and a month later you need a new pesticide to have any effect. Actually, cockroaches can develop multiple resistances. They almost have a superpower when it comes to fighting pesticides. So all we've done in the past is throw buckets of various poisons at them, having no effect, it turns out, except to very possibly make us sick further down the track. Nearly 100 years on from the cockroach wars, we've learned two things. One is that if we build, they will come. The other is that we can't beat them, but we can, to some extent, control them. In the future, whatever process or methods we use, pesticides shouldn't be in the equation. And never mind the cockroaches, we'll be better off for that. Let's walk to the Matagurrup Bridge and the two flying swans, one black, the other white, and representing reconciliation. It's also a fitting place to tell the story of the first man officially to fly a plane in WA. Press pause and talk to you at the bridge. In the first Vic Park walk, I tell you about Pat Hawkins, a cycling star of the 1930s, now nearly forgotten. If you've already taken the first walk, you've also heard about the strange lights seen above Vic Park in 1909. This next story brings the two strands together. Vic Park has a long sporting history. The first golf course in WA was built here in 1895. For a couple of years in the 1930s, Perth Football Club, the Demons, were known as Victoria Park, and later their home ground was at nearby Lathland Park. Just east of us is Belmont Park Racetrack, and where the Optus Stadium now stands used to be another racetrack called Goodwood. Pity the poor punter in December 1917 who had to report from that track. "A disastrous day, all favourites beaten, no booze either towards the end, and the best that can be said about Corstep just now is that he'd take a good photograph." On January the 3rd, 1911, the first aeroplane in Western Australia took off from Belmont Park Racetrack. The pilot was a New Zealander, Joseph Hammond. 25 years old, Hammond had already lived a life of adventure, prospecting in the Klondike, a cowboy in Arizona, a member of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. He was in Sussex, England, when he first set eyes on an aeroplane. It seems lessons, for want of a better word, were pretty casual affairs, and Hammond soon joined the Bristol Aeroplane Company as a demonstration pilot. In 1910, he sailed for Australia with two Bristol B box kites, hoping to interest the Australian government into buying a contract to build more for military reconnaissance. As the name suggests, the box kite looked just like that, a biplane with a pair of cloth wings. The pilot sat up front in a chair out in the open, working direction and altitude with foot pedals and a joystick. The pilot also had to wait for sufficient wind to achieve liftoff. On that day, as the breeze picked up, Hammond took off with literally nothing to protect him from certain death if there was a minor problem. Bear in mind, listening to this report from the Albury-Wodonga Express, yes, in those days, when a plane took off, it made the national news. Oh, and if you think turbulence in a modern jet aircraft is bad, try and put yourself in Hammond's chair over the Swan River, where every bump was a death omen. "When the wind was blowing at the rate of 16 miles an hour, Mr. Hammond rose after a run of 50 yards and soared in spiral movements. He then flew over the river and above the recreation ground at a height of about 1,400 feet. Immediately, in velocity, and the swaying of the machine indicated that Hammond was having a rough passage. After circling for some time and driving down the wind at the rate of 60 miles an hour, Hammond descended safely." Over the next couple of weeks, Hammond and his Bristol box kite were a feature at race meets at Belmont, and if conditions were suitable, he'd putter across the Swan and over King's Park before returning to make his descent. By suitable conditions, the track management also meant after the races, as the belief was the sight of the plane was enough to terrify the horses. In April, Hammond made the first official flight in Sydney, and on one occasion took someone even braver than himself, a photographer who captured the first aerial views of Sydney. During the First World War, Joseph Hammond served as a flight instructor with the Royal Flying Corps in Britain. Sadly, but not surprisingly, he died in 1918 while trying to land at an airfield in Indianapolis, USA. Thousands turned out for his funeral, and we'll remember him for his daring displays over Belmont in January 1911. "Mr. Hammond of the British Biplane Company made a successful flight from the Belmont Park Racecourse over King's Park and back. At one time, he travelled 70 miles an hour." From Matagorda Bridge, we'll take a short walk to Chevron Park, passing Burswood Jetty to our left and Optus Stadium to our right. At Chevron Park, I'll tell you about the trials and tribulations of being a Chinese market gardener here at the beginning of the last century. If you walked between Albany Highway, or Albany Road as it was known then, and the riverbank from the 1890s to the 1920s, you would have passed market gardens, some on quarter-acre blocks, and depending upon the season, there'd be onions, beans, tomatoes, and other fruit and vegetables growing. These were mostly operated by Chinese families, who'd come out during the gold rush and quickly realised there was better money more easily made growing food than digging for gold. For various reasons, one of which I'll come to in a minute, the Chinese inhabitants of Vic Park either didn't want to draw attention to themselves or the press was so casual in spelling names, meaning a lot of these people have disappeared from the records. Two market gardeners here were Ah Chong and Ah Suk. We know about them because in 1897 their garden plots were being raided. One night, Constable Warneck was called to Ah Chong's garden after Ah Chong had wrestled one thief, William Lamore, to the ground. Despite his claims he'd been attacked by an army of Chinese, Lamore was charged, found guilty, and sentenced to a month in prison. Another local gardener was Ching Chang, who was fined in 1900 with hawking vegetables without a licence. Those names, incidentally, were spelt according to rules of the time, which also said the Chinese could be called celestials in the press. The term was meant to be disparaging, though these days there's something endearing and almost beautiful in that word, as though they descended from the heavens. The arrest of Ching Chang reflect other rules of the era. In 1900, when Ching Chang was arrested, the White Australia policy was a year away from being enacted, but the intention was already there. Proponents of the policy claimed Asians, specifically Chinese, were not only taking white people's jobs, but running gambling and opium dens and prostitution rackets, which they might have been. No one complained the same way about European-operated two-up schools or brothels or white doctors casually dispensing morphine or laudanum. Ching Chang was probably another gardener who picked his crop and rather than pay into a local co-op, took it around the streets of Vic Park selling door to door. That kind of small-scale entrepreneurial business was supposedly encouraged in Perth, so long as you weren't Chinese. So, one of the best sources for Chinese inhabitants of Perth remain court records, because the people were frequently arrested for minor offences and because their houses were often raided and everyone present rounded up. In 1896, for example, a herbalist, or as we'd say, a practitioner of traditional medicine, Shou Ken, was arrested for advertising his services without a licence. He protested, to no effect, that he'd never needed one in all his years in Melbourne and Hong Kong, so why now? So, let's turn back and walk to the Burswood Jetty. And on the subject of crime, we'll look at a few that tell us a lot about living here over 100 years ago. Press pause and talk to you then. Talking about crime records, they're a really good way of understanding how the community worked and thought in the past. I don't mean the murders or the bank robberies, but the petty crimes that existed in the past and the reasons why. Arresting Ching Chang for hawking his vegetables shows how deeply racist attitudes seeped into the community. But the Chinese weren't the only people in the sights of law-abiding citizens. Young boys were also a target. In December 1893, two lads, Stewart and Reeves, were caught stealing fruit from Walter Clifton's house in Vic Park. They were let off with a lecture, though the magistrate informed them the maximum penalty was a flogging, 12 lashes with a birch rod. That involved tying the boy down and exposing his buttocks. If you're old enough to remember corporal punishment at school, you might recall how six of the best felt. But 12 lashes with a birch rod for stealing fruit from a tree, and who, by the way, has never committed that wicked crime? In that same court session, two other boys, Jones and Cross, were fined for the offence of bathing in the river near Vic Park during prohibited hours. Both boys were described by the police as incorrigible offenders, though the questions remain, what were legal hours for bathing in the Swan in the 1890s, and why? In 1897, there was a spate of thefts from chicken coops around Vic Park. The police narrowed down their suspects, and one night, Constable Warnick, the same who arrested William Lamore for stealing vegetables from R. Chong and R. Sook, hid in the bushes outside a house next door to one with the coop, waiting for the suspects to turn up. They didn't, but he did overhear a domestic where the man, John Clark, was using some choice language. Constable Warnick promptly went in and arrested Clark for using obscene language within the hearing of passers-by. Apparently, that was an offence, or so Constable Warnick assumed, though the magistrate disagreed and dismissed the case. The problem hinged on the phrase, within earshot, and Clark was able to argue that in order to overhear his bad language, the policeman must have been planted under his kitchen window, essentially on his property without his permission. But seriously, if a man can't swear in his own home. There's no record what happened to the chicken thieves. Incidentally, what crime were residents of Victoria Park likely to front the courts for in the 1930s? Apart from traffic violations, it was listening to the radio without a licence. In the early days of radio, wireless owners were supposed to take out a subscription amounting to 3 guineas, or about £10. Of course, if they built their own wireless, which wasn't hard, they could listen for free. Mindful that Constable Warnick and his finely tuned ears might be in the vicinity. We will now walk to the end of the artificial lake beside Burswood on Swan, where I'll tell you about some of Vic Park's forgotten residents. Talk then. As we come to the end of the walk, let's keep in mind this description of the area that appeared in the West Australian in January 1910. Eastward, the lamps of the causeway run in a long, regular line until they emerge in the little galaxy of lights that overlook the river at Victoria Park. There are lights everywhere, in the heavens above, reflected in the water at our feet, mirrored in midstream, beaconing the far shore, shining in the huge blocks of building across the narrow strip of tarnished sward which separates us from the still busy streets of the city. We've discovered a lot about Vic Park, how it was often disparaged as the source of foul odours and cockroaches, but was also a destination for anyone drawn to the dream of a house in a quiet suburb with access to the river and parks. When the history of a suburb is written, it's usually those in power who get the greatest space – former mayors, politicians, the community leaders. Yet Vic Park, like other suburbs in Perth, has its fair share of inhabitants who didn't get that level of attention, but their presence here casts light on hidden aspects. Let's have a look at just three. In the 1910s, soon after Joseph Hammond flew above Perth from the Belmont Park racetrack, local teenager Robert Warner directed his passions towards inventing a biplane glider. Of course, the biplane gliders were already invented, but he wanted something to improve on previous designs and their propensity for crashing and killing pilots. "I have been studying this question," he told Daily Newsman, "for over 5 years, and I've been very successful with two of my gliders. I have now built a biplane glider which has carried me nearly 400 yards. New arrangements are being made for an exhibition in about 3 weeks' time on the Claremont Showground in aid of the Waifs Home." So, he'd already built two. He knew what he was doing. Sadly, we don't really know what happened to Robert Warner and his biplane, but he was of an age to serve in World War I, and it's a fair guess that if he went and if he returned, his engineering skills would have made him an asset. Edith Burgess was a champion swimmer in Kalgoorlie at the turn of last century, before she married Fred T. Simmons, a projectionist, and moved to Vic Park. They both worked for Spencer's Pictures, one of the earliest cinema production companies in Australia, with branches across the country. Although Charles Spencer produced a handful of short feature films, he always doubted their value, preferring documentaries and a style you could call cinema verite. At that time, the real money lay in short, real-life scenes, where a camera was set up on a street and people were filmed going about their business. Often, they stopped and hammed for the camera. The beauty behind this thinking was that if you filmed a busy street corner, then projected the results in a local hall, people paid the entrance fee on the chance they'd see themselves on camera. In the beginning, Spencer's Pictures had no serious competition in Perth and operated cinema palaces like the Princess on Fremantle's Market Street. In time, they'd have their rivals. But perhaps the real story of cinema in Vic Park has less to do with the people and more to do with the once grand movie palaces that dotted Albany Highway. The Amuse You, with both an indoor and an outdoor cinema on Albany Highway. The Broadway at 330 Albany Highway and the nearby Savoy. Cinemas, especially the old Art Deco ones, are interesting in their own right. But their popularity in Vic Park has a lot to do with its location. Close enough to the city, for anyone who wanted a quick dash across the causeway, Albany Highway fed out to the semi-rural parts of Gosnells and Armidale and Belmont and Guildford weren't far away. People didn't have to drive into the city to have a good night out. You can still see that aspect on Albany Highway today, along the restaurant strip. And you can still see some of the old cinemas and theatres behind new facades. And what about Elizabeth Good, who wasn't exactly a resident of Vic Park, though it's the only place we can be sure she appeared? Go back to the early 1930s. Despite the proximity to the tip and the sewerage works, Vic Park is a very pretty suburb of weatherboard houses and picket fences, but its psychological health isn't so clear. The Wall Street crash and the Depression has seen a lot of people laid off and made unemployed, and World War I was still recent enough that crippled and broken returnees are a common sight. This is a time when people feeling vulnerable reach out for ways to deal with issues that are outside the orthodox. Spiritualists and fortune tellers, anyone who offers consolation for past and future, are in demand. In 1930s Perth, every suburb had several mediums who advertised and others who didn't. And if you said to your friends that you were looking for a way to communicate with the dead, several of them would have offered serious suggestions. In Vic Park, one man laid out some metal letters on a table with an upturned glass to act as a planchette. He was alone at the time, having some personal matters that needed resolving. Unfortunately, he kept being contacted by Elizabeth Good, who was determined that he tell Anne that the necklace is meant for Mary. This made no sense whatsoever, so he tried again. And again, the only person communicating from the other side was Elizabeth Good, repeating her message. Tell Anne that the necklace is for Mary. Weeks later, two friends from Mount Lawley dropped in. He told them the story, and they made the connection, which they could because Anne, one of the visitors, had recently inherited a necklace from her deceased mother, Elizabeth, and her sister Mary had insisted their mother had promised it to her. Anne went home and gave the necklace to Mary. So that's what you might call a win-win situation for everyone concerned. But it's also a reminder that while our suburban streets might look quiet from the outside, indoors can be a lot stranger and more interesting than we can possibly realise. Just like those people we pass on the street, who we think might not warrant a second glance, but have their own unique stories to tell. Walk towards the Vlaming statue, where we'll conclude this walk. So I hope you came away learning something about this area you didn't know earlier. Take the first walk, which begins at McCullum Park, and you'll hear stories of the early European history of Burswood, mysterious objects seen over the sky early last century, and others that will change the way you think about this area. Dr. Noel Nanup, OAM, provided the cultural advice. The audio was mixed and recorded at Fremantle Recording Studios. Thanks to the Town of Vic Park for providing funding for the audio walks and to Vic Park Rotary for auspicing the project. Many of the stories in these audio walks have the beginning at Trove, the online database owned by the National Library of Australia. It is one of this country's great public resources, and we will be poorer without it. Talk to you at the next walk.